Our guest, John Fabian Witt, says that Francis Lieber is a forgotten figure of the American Civil War. President Lincoln asked him to write a code of conduct for soldiers and officers fighting that war. Lieber was a former slave owner who later opposed slavery and had sons who fought for the North and for the South. His code of 157 rules included the prohibition of torture and drew a distinction between combatants and civilians. Lieber plays a central role in Witt's new book. It's called Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History. The book begins with George Washington in 1754 and ends with the Philippine War and traces the struggles to fight and justify warfare, all of which have implications for today's wars and conflicts. John Fabian Witt is the Allen H. Duffy Class of 1960 Professor of Law at Yale Law School. He's also a professor of history in the Yale History Department, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
Is there something uniquely American to have a code of conduct for warfare?
Well, it's a really interesting question. There has been a long history of American commitment to law as an institution of social governance. So there's absolutely something to that. The law of war tradition goes back a long time and has existed in many places. So I don't think having rules for conflict is necessarily distinctly American, but these rules were produced here in the United States.
In fact, if you say, if you go to the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, you can see the sort of seeds, I guess, of these laws, these rules of conduct for war.
Yeah, I'd say that no country has been more organized around the laws of war than the United States, absolutely, from the very beginning.
From the very beginning, because that was how we began, by breaking with Britain.
Right, and the claim was that we were a country entitled to being governed by the laws of war. We weren't just a bunch of criminal conspirators engaged in a criminal rebellion. And the king, of course, said otherwise.
I was going to say, but the king had a very different point of view on
that.
That's
right, that's right, yeah.
But do you think, part of it, it seems like it's a good thing to have codes of war. But the question is whether in the reality of war, soldiers, officers, leaders abide by those laws.
Well, this is always a grave problem. These are invariably morally grave, incredibly stressful situations. And so the fact that there's even a tradition here is kind of an amazing thing that is worth remarking on. Now, the fact that our laws against laws of crime get violated doesn't mean there aren't criminal laws. And the same is true, I think, for the laws of war.
You write about, and as I said in my introduction, this is really in many ways built around this man named Francis Lieber, as you say, a forgotten figure of the Civil War. Why do you think, first of all, we have forgotten him, and then let's remember him?
Well, it's a great question, because historians of the Civil War have, I think, understated Lieber's significance and the significance of the project that he was engaged in. And I think the reason is they've imagined that the laws of war must be a humanitarian set of rules that are protective. And then they look at things like Sherman's March to the Sea, and they imagine this was an irrelevant sideshow in the course of the war. The laws of war turn out to be much more ambiguous. They license as well as restrict. And Lieber's role is actually quite important in a bunch of recessive, underattended ways.
And why was he chosen? Or I guess why did Lincoln tap him to do this?
Well, Lieber is one of the most enthusiastic and sometimes garrulous members of the public intellectual class of the pre-Civil War United States. He was here in Philadelphia in the 1830s and then in South Carolina thereafter. And he was a constant correspondent with a bunch of the members of Lincoln's inner circle, including Henry Halleck, who became general-in-chief in late 1862. And so those connections brought him to the administration's attention.
But the fact that you have someone who at one point owned slaves and then opposed slavery, had sons who fought on both sides of this war, do you see that ambivalence in his code?
Well, the
or
rules,
his struggle, perhaps?
No, that's a great observation. The rules are rules that are both fierce. Lieber is a fierce advocate of the Union, thinks the Union should fight more aggressively from the very beginning, and the rules that he writes embody that view. On the other hand, there's a heroic humanitarianism to the rules, an effort to restrict and limit wanton violence. And I think having sons on both sides, I think, made that very plain to him.
What are some of these rules?
Well, there's a strict rule against torture, which is very interesting. There's also a strict rule against poison. We have reason to know that Lieber himself was ambivalent about the poison rule and wasn't sure that it should be the rule. But in the code that he issued and that Lincoln issues as an order to the Union Army, there is a no poison rule. There are a variety of rules about truce flags, prisoners of war. The most important set of rules in the code, and this is what the book has brought out and I hadn't expected to find when I went into the project, were rules about black prisoners of war, black soldiers in the Union. The South had announced that they would not be treated as prisoners of war. They'd be treated as criminals. And what the code does is announce that international law forbids that.
And how did he and perhaps even Lincoln and those in the 19th century, how did they define what torture was?
Well, there's a long tradition of torture going back into the European Middle Ages, also a variety of practices in Indian warfare, which had become highly salient after frontier wars in the 18th and then into the early 19th century. The definition of torture wasn't much thought about. We don't have the same battles that we have today about what the definition of torture is. I think people thought it was common sense. What torture was.
Which was if you're inflicting pain on somebody else, that's probably some version of torture?
I think some version of that. We do know that the water cure, which is a 19th century version of waterboarding, was treated as torture under Lieber's code some 50 years after the code was, 40 years after the code was put together.
And this was a code that was given to soldiers, to officers, right? I mean, they carried it around as they fought the Civil War.
That's absolutely right. It's the first example of the wallet card tradition today. I mean, today soldiers have wallet cards, and since Vietnam, they've carried around these cards, which give them instructions on what to do with prisoners and the like. And this is the first example of that. Until this point, the laws of war were in Latin or French, in multi-volume treatises for diplomats and theorists. But this is a pamphlet printed by the thousands for officers in the field.
You also write about, and your book is called Lincoln's Code. I mean, you also write about Lincoln's perhaps initial reluctance to even think about the laws of war or conduct under war. I mean, he's a lawyer. He didn't have much of a military career that I'm aware of. Why do you think he didn't embrace this early on?
Well, he comes into the war a real law skeptic on this point, and we see that at the very outset of the war when he adopts contradictory positions on the blockade and the problem of privateers. The privateers are Southerners commissioned by the Confederate government to fight against Northern shipping. He starts out as a skeptic that any of these categories matter much, but he quickly learns that they're useful to him. Not that he needs to follow them idolatrously, but that they're useful in ways to advance the project of the Union armed conflict.
Well, as you mentioned in the early days of the colonies, Britain saw us as treasonous and criminals, probably trying to break from the British Empire. Sounds like Lincoln, that's how he viewed the South, at least initially, that these were criminals and secession was illegal.
Well, that's the initial position of the Union. After the first battle at Bull Run, there are thousands of Union prisoners held by the South, and that position isn't really available anymore, at least officially, because the South can threaten to retaliate against Union soldiers held by the South. And so from the middle of the summer of 1861 on, there's a real question about how to organize the conflict. And the laws of war become the default set of organizing principles.
But it sounds like Lincoln approached this as a pragmatist, not as a moralist or even an idealist.
I think that's right. He is famously pragmatic, but pragmatism won't tell us enough here. It turns out that invoking these rules pragmatically had long-term effects. So once Lincoln had called the war a war and had treated the South as entitled to the laws of war, it turned out he couldn't then prosecute for treason Jefferson Davis after the war. It was just too difficult, having called it a war for 4 years, to try to go back. And there are any number of long-term effects like that, entailments, to invoking the laws of war.
And this was a code that was used by, or at least on paper, by both sides.
Well, it's interesting. Yes, it's invoked, it's created by the Union, and it's handed over to the South. And the South cries bitterly, especially because they understand that it's a part of the emancipation effort and it's part of the protection of black soldiers. But there are provisions in there that the South finds very useful, and the South quickly seizes on, especially involving prisoners of war and parole, which is letting prisoners of war go on an oath not to fight until they're exchanged. And the parole rules were used by the South. So the South did actually invoke this code itself.
But was Lincoln's embrace of the code his way of thinking, this is how we're going to win this war?
I think that's Halleck's project, and it's the Lincoln administration's project. Right. You know, we only have one moment. Lincoln and Lieber knew one another And yet there's only one moment where we know that Lincoln comes together with the code, and that's over the question of black soldiers in retaliation. So in July of 1863, Lincoln issues an order promising to retaliate for the execution or enslavement of black soldiers or their white Union officers by the South. And that retaliation order tracks the language of the code perfectly. So Lincoln's engaged there with the project of the code.
In fact, you say the code helps us understand the Emancipation Proclamation.
That's right. It's one of the legacies of the Emancipation Proclamation. I came to think in the middle of the book, the big problem is, why do they issue this code? Why would the strong side, at the moment that it's taking off the gloves, issue a code of rules to constrain itself? And I think the answer is to legitimate emancipation, which had been seen as an uncivilized act of war for 90 years in the United States.
Can you expand on that a bit? I mean, how the code helped Lincoln think about and then write this Emancipation Proclamation.
So the from 1775 onward, when the last royal governor of Virginia, Lord Dunmore, proclaimed the freedom of any slaves who had come to his side against the rebels, American statesmen had been insisting that freeing an enemy slave in wartime was an uncivilized act of barbaric warfare. So when it comes to the summer and fall of 1862, when Lincoln decides on emancipation, he's flying in the face of 90 years of tradition to the contrary. Because his claim is that he can do this under the war power. So what the code does is it reverses the U.S. position on what international law on the question of slavery was. And those are the most novel provisions in the code. There are more articles about slavery and black prisoners than about any other subject. Prisoners of war, truce flags, torture, and any other subject.
So if you can treat black soldiers more fairly, then you can treat slaves more fairly as well. Well, or that they are deserving of protection and rights.
That's I don't know that the code comes in. So the code is commissioned in December of 1862, which is a couple months after the announcement of emancipation, and just 3 weeks before it comes into play. So January 1st, 1863 is when the final Emancipation Proclamation is issued. So the code doesn't help inspire emancipation. It's rather forced by emancipation. It's created by the occasion of emancipation. It does signal for us, though, the kind of emancipation that Lincoln and the Lincoln administration has in mind. And it's an emancipation that's contained and humane. And one of the dimensions of the humanity is no uprisings against white Southern households. That's one of the real concerns that drives this.
And you think has ties to the code itself?
Yeah, so we see, for example, some provisions of the code that I think are implicitly, and I think it was understood at the time, implicitly saying to white Southerners, you have to respect black soldiers as soldiers, give them prisoner of war protections, but slave uprisings or freed people uprisings after January 1st, 1863, behind your lines, we don't require that you treat those as those people as soldiers, which is an interesting and not altogether happy feature of the code.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is John Fabian Witt, and we're talking about his new book. It's called Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History. And he's a professor at Yale University, grew up here in the Philadelphia area. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Penn Museum supports WHYY. It's December 2012. Did the Maya predict the world would end this month? The answer is at Maya 2012, Lords of Time, a special exhibit now in its final weeks. The exhibition explores predictions of an apocalypse and their possible origins in the ancient Maya civilization. It features artifacts from the UNESCO World Heritage Site in Copan, Honduras, and state-of-the-art technology and interactive experiences. More at penn.museum/2012.
The sound of these voices means Christmas for so many people around the world. The men and boys of the choir of King's College, Cambridge, as they create magic each year with a festival of 9 lessons and carols.
News of great joy, news of great wealth.
I'm Michael Barone. Don't miss our broadcast from England, from American Public Media.
Monday morning at 10 on WHYY.
When rap pioneer Run from the group Run DMC first got active in church, he had no idea how far it would go.
collar got wrapped around my neck. I don't know how it happened. I started an usher. I ended up a reverend.
We'll find out how Reverend Run went from rapping to preaching next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, John Fabian Witt is our guest, and we're talking about his new book called Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History. How a country fights a war is a question that has challenged every American president, from George Washington to Barack Obama. Our guest is a professor of law and history at Yale University, and we do have some open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Well, thinking about this code and the 157 rules in the code, so on the one hand, we've got the Emancipation Proclamation. On the other hand, we have Sherman's March to the Sea, where he and his troops just mowed down, you know, parts of the South. How does the code help us understand both of these things?
Well, I think the code stitches the two together in ways that are sometimes disturbing. So it turns out that Francis Lieber's great teacher on the laws of war was a man named Karl von Clausewitz, who's a Prussian theorist of war, who comes out of much the same experience. Lieber's born in Prussia, comes out of much the same experience in Berlin under Napoleon in 1806. And Lieber and Clausewitz think of war as something that's virtuous, something that encourages civilization. They're fierce advocates of warfare, although not warmongers. Mm-hmm. And that approach to the rules creates a set of rules that license a lot of violence. Emancipation is itself a form of violence against the private rules of the South. And Sherman's March is much the same.
So you've got this kind of righteousness and sort of hubris or arrogance.
That's right.
Or entitlement, right?
Well, the underlying standard that runs through the code, with the exception of the rules against torture and poisons and maybe a couple others, is the rule of military necessity. Mm-hmm. Armies are allowed to do what's necessary to advance a legitimate war aim. And that's a terrible warrant for lots and lots of violence. And much of the contemporary laws of war today try to move away from that as much as they can. But Lieber thought necessity was the right standard.
You wrote something about this in Slate magazine actually a couple of years ago. The code allowed for the destruction of civilian property, the bombardment of civilians in besieged cities, the starving of non-combatants, and the emancipation of civilian slaves, as we have been talking about, permitted executing prisoners in cases of necessity or retaliation.
Well, one of the most dangerous parts of the code is Lieber's critique, which he shares with Clausewitz and with others, like Frederick the Great, Machiavelli. He says, sharp wars are short wars, and short wars are more humane. Mm. Now, there's a powerful critique there of a humanitarian approach to warfare that would limit the violence of warfare, but maybe allow it to drag out, maybe produce more wars if war is less extreme. Mm. So that's the ambiguity.
But I'm also thinking about our own Civil War, and just I know more than 500,000 people died. I've been to Gettysburg, you know, I've seen some of these battlefields, and they're haunting places. It was such a violent and bloody war. Do you think this code made it one way or the other? I mean, would it have been worse without this code?
Well, one of the difficulties is figuring out what it means to say would it have been worse.
Right.
So I think that the code, one of its major effects is to actually exacerbate the prisoner of war situation, to make it worse, not better. It does that, though, for good reasons. That is, the Union is insisting that black prisoners of war be exchanged on equal terms with white prisoners of war in the prisoner exchanges that existed in the first 2 years of the conflict. The code is part of the Union's announcement that it will not engage in unequal prisoner exchanges. That ends prisoner exchanges and produces things like Andersonville Prison in Georgia and Elmira Prison in New York, which are horrible, horrible places in which tens of thousands of people die. So that prisoner exchange problem is created for good reason, but it's exacerbated by the code, which takes justice to be as an important project as humanitarianism.
The sort of unintended, I guess, consequences of the code.
Right, that's right. It's full of, and this is one of the ways in which the code really does have an important effect on the war in a way that Civil War historians haven't really understood.
And do we know, I'm thinking of these soldiers carrying around this code in their pocket, I mean, would they refer to it?
So here's one
Or perhaps their officers refer to it?
One of the reasons why Civil War historians have rightly seen the code as not being as significant is we don't see Sherman taking out his code when he arrives at Atlanta and decides whether or not to shell the city. Mm-hmm. The code isn't consulted in the way that the JAG officers today do consult with targeting commanders in armed conflict in the 21st century. We don't see that. What we do see, though, is the code playing important roles in things like military commissions. It's a blueprint for military commissions throughout the war, and there are 1,000 of them charging law of war violations. We see it in the Black Prisoner of War area, and we see it licensing the kinds of violence that mm-hmm. Sherman is engaged in. So those are three important areas.
You also talk about that at least the code tried to keep lines of communication open between the combatants.
Yeah, this is one of the central important features of the laws of war. There are actually a lot of ways in which enemies want to be able to cooperate with one another in many conflicts. Not all. And some of the worst are ones where they don't want to communicate. But so long as the sides want to be able to, for example, surrender or call a truce for a short time to clear bodies from the field, then some kind of communication needs to exist. And there need to be rules that allow for that kind of communication. And that's one of the central features of the code.
You begin with a story about George Washington before he was President George Washington. What's the story about?
Well, in the Ohio Valley in 1754, Washington found himself caught up in the deaths of a group of French soldiers, and controversy quickly spread out across the Atlantic world about whether Washington had been complicit in the assassination of French soldiers there in the early imperial competition between Great Britain and France that would lead to the Seven Years' War. We know it as the French and Indian War.
Yes.
And that early episode haunted Washington for years to come. He was, in the middle of the 18th century, one of the most notorious violators, or he was thought to be by many, of the law of war tradition, which is an old tradition going way back.
In fact, the governor of New France, you quote him in your book, says there is nothing more unworthy and lower and even blacker than the sentiments and way of thinking of this Washington, talking to George Washington. But you're saying this haunted him?
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to start off with that story is I think we have a sense in the United States today that the laws of war are a subject of political controversy in the last decade. But I think these controversies have gone back since the very beginning of the Republic. The kinds of contestation, the debates among idealists and cynics, accusations of hypocrisy, and real hopes that the laws of war have held have been with us for as long as the country has been here.
Well, and let's get ourselves up to present day, looking at these codes of war and thinking about the kinds of wars that we have fought in the last decade or so, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan, or the treatment of suspects, terror suspects in Guantanamo Bay. Do you see the kind of haunting of this early history in our current history today?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. One of the things that's often said is that today's wars pose new challenges that have no precedent. We now fight unconventional conflicts, for example. Well, it turns out that unconventional conflicts have been going on since Washington found himself in the woods with Indians in the 1750s in the Ohio Valley. The Civil War itself was an unconventional conflict. The South was thought of by the Union as not a legitimate combatant. So unconventional wars have been with us throughout. It's in some ways an anomaly of the middle of the 20th century that we had these large set-piece battles.
But the fact that, for instance, we tortured terror suspects, I mean, are you saying that that's sort of almost part of the code, part of our history?
Well,
part of war?
I would say that the acute grave difficulty of torture has been with us for a long time. So we see in the Philippines, and the book ends in the Philippines, because
yes.
I wanted to use this as an example of the extraordinarily difficult situations. The code says no to torture. The code was the governing set of rules in the Philippines. Now, as an aside, it's interesting that it was. There's no reason why the United States had to, as a matter of international law, apply those rules to themselves in the Philippines, but we did. And in those conflicts in the Philippines, the United States engaged in systematic torture of villagers to find out where insurgents were, and then prosecuted immediately thereafter in court-martials a number of people for violating those rules, for torturing.
In fact, you include some photos of Filipinos being, I guess, waterboarded in the way that is conducted today, but certainly being held and water forced down their throat.
Yeah, it was called the water cure, and it's essentially a last century's a century and a half ago's version of what we know as as waterboarding today. One of the great paradoxes of this is that one of the chief water cure advocates and tacticians becomes the author of the 20th century law of war manual that updates and replaces the Lieber Code. And that's one of the darkest parts of the book for me.
Indeed. But it does raise questions about whether under war circumstances or why in the Philippines this was done, even though it was against the code. Why did people engage in this, and why were they allowed to do this?
Well, there are situations in which information and information gathering seems imperative. Huge pressure is put. And the basic contest is between the pursuit of ends that are thought to be righteous, that is winning the war in the Philippines, or winning the Civil War, mm-hmm. I think of Sherman's March, and on the other hand, a humanitarian modesty. There was, in Lincoln, it was brilliant on this, the realization, and this is foundational to the law of war tradition then and today, the realization that, you know, we might be wrong in our righteous ends. We have to act. We live in a world of danger. We live in a world of evil. Morality requires that we act, sometimes with force, and yet we're constantly aware that we might be wrong. And that's the acute balance on which we rest in these sorts of situations.
And that's Lincoln's struggle?
He sits down in August of 62, maybe September 62, we don't really know, and writes out some notes as he thinks through emancipation. And he engages in just this struggle. He says, I know that Union soldiers are praying, but I know that Confederate soldiers pray too. Mm. And how do I know which side has better access? We don't live in the age of miracles, he says. And he has to struggle and think it through.
Let me reintroduce you. And again, our guest is John Fabian Witt. We're talking about his new book. It's called Lincoln's Code, and it's subtitled The Laws of War in American History. Getting a lot of history in this hour of Radio Times, talking about this all-important issue. And our guest is a professor at Yale University, grew up here in the Philadelphia area, and lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dick Cheney famously talked about going over to the dark side. And this was his, I would say, justification for the treatment of terror suspects early on in after September 11th. Do you see parallels to that statement in what we've been talking about?
Well, there are, for a very long time, examples of statesmen, soldiers, jurists in the United States who've expressed great disdain for the laws of war. And we saw a good deal of this in the Bush administration. What's striking to me is that examples going back to, say, Andrew Jackson, who in some ways is really the forerunner to the Bush administration, he and his political allies had lots of contempt for pointy-headed Europeans and the rules they tried to use to impose on Americans. But even those critics of the laws of war found themselves bound back into the laws of war and bound back into a conversational frame created by the ideas of morality in armed conflict. We certainly saw the Bush administration drawn back into this. They couldn't get out of arguments about the rules of warfare, even though they tried to set them aside at the outset.
And do you see the Geneva Conventions coming out of these rules of war? Codes of conduct.
So this is one of the most striking features of this story, is that the rules we have today for warfare, international law rules in the Geneva Conventions, are rules that started here with Lincoln. In the latter part of the 19th century, European states pick up the rules that Lincoln and Lieber issued. They turn them into the Hague Conventions in 1899 and again in 1907, and we see them still in the Geneva Conventions of 1949. So Lincoln's legacy here is really quite powerful. We're arguing about Lincoln in Afghanistan.
But what's interesting and troubling is that you look at World War I and, of course, the use of gas. Lieber said gas should not be used during a war. It was clearly used then. You look at just the horror of the Second World War as well. And I keep coming back to this about whether, you know, the code exists sort of on this piece of paper or whether it actually influences what is done on a battlefield or how one thinks about war or starting a war.
Right. Some critics of the Laws of War point out that the proliferation of texts in the Laws of War is accompanied by the rise of some of the most horrific horrors of modern warfare. It may be that the Laws of War in some ways are an apology for this. I hold a modestly more optimistic view, only modestly. The Laws of War are an incredibly fraught tradition. But they've also created some toeholds for humanitarianism, if only by finding ways to allow enemies to cooperate when enemies want to cooperate. It's hard to cooperate in warfare, even when you want to. And if we have a tradition that allows that to happen, even interstitially, that's a heroic thing.
But I'm also thinking about the treatment of terror suspects and the struggle to figure out whether they belong in civilian courts. I mean, clearly Congress and others oppose that. Or how they are treated or viewed in a military commission. They don't fight for a country necessarily. They're in many ways allied with a thinking, an ideology. Again, are there roots of that in what we've been talking about?
Well, absolutely, because so many conflicts in the 19th century were with non-state actors, whether they're Indians or whether they were Confederates or in the Philippines. The striking feature of these engagements has been the constant frustration the United States has felt, and I think other countries have felt this too, with what the law of war tries to do, which is separate crime and war and set aside the criminal laws when warfare is at issue. Now, the commissions that prosecute soldiers on the other side, or combatants on the other side, mm-hmm. I should say, are efforts to break down that sharp division between crime and war. And the U.S. soldiers, jurists, statesmen have been involved in that from all the way back, especially the Mexican War in particular.
And do you think we're closer to resolving that conflict between crime and war?
Oh, no, I don't think we see resolution on these things. I think what we see is ongoing conversation and ongoing contestation. So what the laws of war do, they don't deliver resolution. They don't deliver answers on these things. Mm-hmm. We're not going to come to answers. What we're going to do is we're going to be engaged in an ongoing set of very difficult conversations, an ongoing set of institutional experiments. And the law of war tradition is going to structure and shape those conversations and those institutions.
And how we think about enemy combatants, even literally what we call them.
Right, absolutely.
That was part of a struggle about what do we call these people.
Right, and that was in some ways the Lieber Code tradition at odds with and coming into conflict with the Geneva tradition that's grown up in Europe and in North America in the last 60 years.
And just to underscore what you said earlier, I mean, part of Lieber and also Lincoln, the idea of these codes was to also figure out how the North could win the Civil War.
That's right. This is a code issued to help the Lincoln administration win the war.
Right.
That's the only reason they commissioned it in December of 1862, at just the moment they've decided to fight a much more aggressive campaign. It's also the only reason why nation states around the world have adopted these rules. That is, nation states don't adopt these rules because they're secretly pacifist. They adopt these rules in an effort to accomplish their ends.
Well, let me pick up on that, and we're going to take another very short break. We've got some calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And again, our guest is John Fabian Witt, author of a new book called Lincoln's Code, and it's subtitled The Laws of War in American History. We've been talking about American history, of course, talking about some of the challenges today. He's a professor of law and history at Yale University. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Pifaro, the Renaissance band, supports WHYY. This weekend, Pifaro celebrates the holidays in German Renaissance style with three area concerts. Featuring soprano Laura Himes, Pifaro will perform chorales, hymns, motets, and seasonal party music from composers Michael Praetorius and others. And audience participation is welcome for the traditional Wechselgesang. Concerts are in Chestnut Hill December 21st, Center City December 22nd, and Wilmington December 23rd. Tickets, times, and venue locations at pifaro.com.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Chase, creator of The Sopranos, about his first film, Not Fade Away. Set in New Jersey in the 60s, it's about the lead singer and a high school garage band emulating the Rolling Stones and Dylan. We'll also talk with Stephen Van Zandt of Springsteen's band, the movie's music supervisor. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have an unflinching look at homelessness from three budding writers who tell their own stories. Also, we'll have the latest in the rippling effects of the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with John Fabian Witt. He is the Allen H. Duffy Class of 1960 Professor of Law at Yale Law School. He's also a professor of history at the, in the Yale History Department, author of several books. I'll give you their titles, Patriots and Cosmopolitans, Hidden Histories of American Law, The Accidental Republic, Crippled Working Men, Destitute Widows, and the Remaking of American Law. And we're talking about his new one called Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let's get some callers into the conversation. We have Georgina from Ocean City. And Georgina, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Witt. My question has to do with the use of drones as lethal weapons. It seems like the U.S. government is waging a global war in its search for al-Qaeda suspects. And I'm very concerned that civilian bodies like the CIA have become the judge, jury, and executioner of people in countries where we're not at war, like Pakistan and Yemen, Somalia, and now Mali. And I just wonder about these rules. It would appear that I'm concerned about accountability, also that U.S. lives are more valuable than U.S. lives are more valuable than the lives of other people. And I wonder...
Well, you know what, Georgia, let me take your question. It's a good one. It was on my list as well. And let me give our guest, John Fabian Witt, a chance to respond.
Well, so these are great questions. Yeah. One of the central problems for the law of war tradition, and you see it in the drones, is there is no impartial adjudicator. The law of war can't find some neutral third party. We have the International Criminal Court now, which is an effort, much contested, not yet signed on to by the United States, to create such a neutral third party adjudicator. But in the absence of those neutral third party adjudicators, we rely on states to apply their own rules. And we now have a wide body of NGOs, and this is, you see this in the drones especially, who are observers who try to bring to public light these kinds of questions. The difficulty with the drones, it strikes me, is that the apparatus we have for critiquing the use of force has become reliant on what goes by the unfortunate phrase collateral damage. We look to see about the casualties to bystanders. Now, the problem with the drones from this perspective is they're increasingly accurate. And with each passing year, the amount of bystander injury and death will be going down. We should expect to see this into the future. That the drones, though, create a huge problem. They're extraordinarily inexpensive to use. They don't require that we put much political capital on the line ourselves or many human lives ourselves. And so that's the difficulty with the drones. They've evaded the moral apparatus of the laws of war that we have today.
Georgina, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Also, part of that program, I think, that is troubling is that it is secret. There's much we don't know about it. I think we know when there has been a strike, and as Georgina said, there have been casualties. My understanding is that President Obama signs off on each and every one of these drone strikes. I don't know if that should make us feel good or worrisome, but it seems to be happening behind closed doors.
Well, one of the striking features about the law of war today as it operates in Washington, D.C., is there are thousands of lawyers in the executive branch, in the Pentagon, in the State Department, who engage in these kinds of law of war questions. There are lawyers in the armed services. There are lawyers over the shoulder of targeting officers in the areas where the drones are operated. Mm-hmm. So there are lawyers everywhere. In 1862, the Lincoln administration had to reach out to a Lieber, who was a Columbia College professor at that point. He wasn't in the White House. He was an outsider. And now there's a huge amount of activity inside the government doing this. And one of the effects is a secrecy. There's a capacity to close the doors on what's going on.
But are you also saying that when a war becomes so antiseptic and perhaps even so strategic, it just raises other questions, or there's the impulse to use it perhaps when other means might be a better approach?
Well, I guess what I mean to say is that it defeats the mechanisms we've used to contain war to this point. So Lieber thought that getting rid of irrationality in warfare would be the wanton violence, the soldiers who run amok and kill farmers along the way. Lieber was very worried about Sherman's march for this reason. What Sherman was doing, Lieber thought was appropriate. What the Sherman's bummers, the stragglers, did, he thought was a terrible thing. Now, the problem with the drones is that they are the ultimate rational war-fighting machine. They're perfectly clean, as you say. And so fighting against wanton violence doesn't really get us anywhere with the drones.
I'm thinking also of a story I read about what's been going on in Aleppo in Syria as the sort of opposite, which is just the bombing of neighborhoods, the what looks like or appears to be the almost complete destruction of a city, and of course much of the civilian population either running for their lives or have been targeted.
Well, civil wars have always been among the most difficult for the laws of war to regulate, partly because one side insists that the other side isn't a legitimate combatant, that it isn't a legitimate belligerent. So it's one of the striking, amazing features of the civil war in the United States is that the laws of war did have some hold. Mm-hmm. They did have some bite. We don't have mass prisoner executions. We don't, except with respect to black prisoners by the South. So the fact the law of war gets any hold at all in the Civil War, and then, in fact, our modern laws of war come out of the Civil War, is really an extraordinary fact.
We haven't really talked about the treatment of the Indians, but we should, and then we'll get back to our callers. Go ahead.
Well, the Indian story is a really interesting one. It's one that I hadn't expected to encounter in the way that I did. Indian warfare from the very beginning of the Republic had created a series of law of war crises, but it created law of war crises not because the Indians didn't abide by any law of war, but rather because they had a different law of war. It turned out that Indians had, maybe in many ways, a more successful mechanism for containing war's violence. But to European eyes and then to American eyes, it looked horrific. It involved the ritual torture of a single enemy prisoner rather than the destruction of an entire village, let's say. And when these two different mechanisms for regulating warfare came in conflict, oftentimes it meant just a race to the bottom and no rules at all.
Mm. Let me get, looks like Whitney from Westchester to join our conversation. And Whitney, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Thank you. I am calling because I'm a Quaker, and so I have a deeply held religious conviction that all war, regardless of the rules, is immoral. And yet, religion and morality and war are very intrinsically linked. And so I'm just curious what your guest has to say about the intersection of those three things. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Whitney, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead.
That's a great question. I'm a product of Quaker schooling here in Philadelphia, and so I've thought about these issues a lot. One of the most interesting features of the story to me was the pacifist movement of the first half of the 19th century. It's a movement that sees the laws of war as an effort to apologize for the abominable. The laws of war, say the pacifists, are apologies for crime. And what's interesting about that pacifist movement is it collapses on the rise of the Civil War. Pacifists find themselves having to choose between their abolitionism and their pacifism, since war is the way that that slavery comes to an end. But we've oftentimes forgotten about the strength of that pre-war pacifist movement as a result of the way in which it collapses in the midst of the war. Pacifists have long thought that the laws of war are really in error, that we ought not try to humanize what is a horrific set of acts.
Something that cannot be humanized.
That's right. That's right. Charles Sumner gave a great 1845 address on July 4th in Boston, in which he accused the soldiers in his audience of being criminals. These were rules of wrong, he said, not rules of war, rules of wrong.
In fact, you quote him, "What is war but organized murder?" This is what he says in 1845.
That's right. So this is there's a powerful critique of the laws of war from a long time ago, seeing them as legitimating violence. And of course, I think that's one of the things the Lincoln administration wanted to do with the laws of war, was legitimate the violence that they thought was in the right they were engaged in the Civil War. So pacifists have had a long and complicated tradition. One strand in the rules of war has been a strand advanced by people I'd call secret pacifists, people who recognize that pacifism isn't available in the here and now, and so try to use the laws of war as the camel's nose under the tent to begin the process of pacification, moving towards pacifism. Others, like Lieber, have thought of war as an important feature of Western civilization, a preserver of civilization as against moral decay and against evil. And for them, the laws of war haven't been about pacifism at all.
Does he reflect, or does Lincoln share those views that Lieber did?
Well, we know, because of the way Lincoln thinks about just wars, that Lincoln is not a secret pacifist, that Lincoln thinks that force must be used when it's required. And so it's in that light that he turns to, his administration turns to, a set of rules.
Also, he had problems, I guess, early on in the war with McClellan, who didn't seem to want to fight very much. Was this a fight over sort of the codes of war, or a president that wanted a more aggressive military?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the chief disagreements between McClellan and the Lincoln administration, once we get late in the summer of 1862, is over the question of slavery. And McClellan holds to the longstanding American tradition that freeing enemy slaves in wartime is an abomination, that it's an uncivilized act of war. And by the July and August of 62, Lincoln has come to think, privately at first and then slowly sharing it with some members of his cabinet, that slavery has to come to an end. And if that's going to happen, they needed a new set of rules, and they probably needed a new general-in-chief.
And got rid of McClellan.
That's right.
Let's see what Wayne from Mount Airy has to say. And Wayne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Very interesting program.
Thank you.
I wanted to comment on the treatment of black soldiers during the Civil War, particularly in the Battle of Fort Pillow, Tennessee, which is located near or around the area of Pulaski, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. The black soldiers had surrendered because they had been outnumbered and they had numerous wounded. And when the Confederates came into the area that they were awaiting evacuation, the wounded were bayoneted on the ground and shot. The rest of the survivors were shot, and this became the basis for a battle cry that continued throughout the war as far as black soldiers were concerned. Remember Fort Pillow.
Oh, interesting. Wayne, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You want to respond to that, John?
Well, Fort Pillow is one of the most notorious incidents of something that happened a lot on the ground, which was the execution in the aftermath of battle of black soldiers. We see reports among Confederate officers. These aren't just Union accusations. That is, we've long had for a century and more, correspondence among Confederate officers essentially admitting to the execution of black prisoners. It was proposed by Confederate leaders as the solution to the problem. Now, in some ways, the view was that black soldiers were criminals, that it wasn't an extra lawful matter to execute them. It was consistent with one view from the South of the law of the battlefield, which is these were unlawful combatants who were not entitled to prisoner of war protections. But it did produce a stern response from the Union, in the form of Lincoln's retaliation promise, and in the form of the code.
Mm. Wayne, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You have a photograph in here of a prisoner of war who looks like he could have been in Auschwitz. I mean, he's just a skeleton sitting, I think, on a box or something.
It's one of the photos from the Civil War that I think speaks most powerfully to 20th and 21st century readers about the war. Mm-hmm. And I included it in there to try to bring out the way in which the laws of war force choices between humanitarianism on the one hand and justice on the other. Mm-hmm. That man found himself in that condition because the Union had insisted on stopping prisoner exchanges. And that stopping of prisoner exchanges happened in large part, not entirely, but in large part, over the question of black prisoners.
Right. And so he was starving. I mean, he was being held as a prisoner and starving.
That's right. Because, I mean, the Union kept insisting that it would engage in prisoner exchanges if only the South would include black prisoners on an equal basis. And the South refused to go along with that.
Let me see what Christine from West Philadelphia has to say. Christine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for another great show.
Thank you.
I'm curious about the term humanitarian bombing, and I'm wondering if your guest can offer some insight into the history and use of this phrase.
Do you know this phrase?
Well, so you're thinking about Kosovo and the like? Is that...
Is that what you're thinking of, Christine?
Yes, very much so.
Right, during the Clinton years.
Well, so this is the problem of humanitarian intervention, and there are a variety of different mechanisms for armed force, bombing being one of them. I mean, you could think of the approach to the laws of war that the Lincoln administration engages in the winter of 62-63 as a forerunner to that kind of thing. It's an effort to turn the new emancipation project of the war toward the laws of war, and to license the moral force of emancipation for the war effort. And that's what we see in the humanitarian intervention episodes, sometimes for better and sometimes for worse.
Christine, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Because of the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we're all kind of Lincoln-obsessed. How do you see him then as a president, and clearly a war president, but having done a book like this, what do you walk away with thinking about that president?
Well, he's an amazing self-taught thinker about the laws of war, and not one who treated the laws of war as something that he needed to be religiously faithful to, but also not one who thought of the laws of war as just a set of annoying, frustrating obstacles to be evaded. So the laws of war for Lincoln shape the way he approaches some of the most morally grave situations of the conflict, like the emancipation moment.
Because he was a lawyer at heart, do you think?
I think there is something to that. You know, having read 18th century English law texts by way of his self-training earlier in the 19th century, he'd encountered this material. But then I think he encountered it, he also encountered it through Shakespeare, interestingly. He was a big fan of Shakespeare, and Shakespeare is shot through with moments of the laws of war, especially Henry V. But he also encountered it on the ground in problems that he encountered, beginning in April 61 and then ongoing throughout the war. You just couldn't avoid it.
Well, John Fabian Witt, thank you very much for joining us today, Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. The book is called Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History, and he's a professor at the Yale Law School and also the Yale History Department. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, and the archives. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up next, it's Here and Now. We do rebroadcast Radio Times. You can tune in tonight from 10 until